Today I'm with Mr. Ian Quick, author of Follies and Fragile States, How the International Stabilization Failed in the Congo. Welcome to IPI, Mr. Quick. The subtitle of your book is How International Stabilization Failed in the Congo, which you explain in what you call five follies. How did you decide on these five follies?
That is an excellent question. It could be four, it could be six, it could be 100. But really, what I was trying to do with the book and with the work that I'm doing after the publication of the book is unpack this fact of strategic failure that we saw in 2012 into issues that are tractable. I say tractable in the sense that institutions who are working there can engage with them as areas where they need to do better. And this is not a very, very big fact, like the resurgence of violence in 2012. That's too broad. It's not a very, very narrow fact, like Project X failed. There's some good middle ground where you can pin down and say, these are the things we don't really know how to do very well. This is what has led us to this situation.
In your book, you mention areas where the Congolese state has never had control and places where communities preferred armed groups over the state. What are the inherent challenges of extending state authority when the state is not wanted or trusted?
There are many challenges in doing so. I like to think of this along a longer historical arc. In the DRC, this is a century or so back to the colonial period. You have repeated attempts to establish central control, but also legitimacy in these areas. So delivery of services in addition to sort of harder power, policing and security control. And what they ran into was a very dense ecosystem of local actors and political and civic structures for regulating how people lived together. And these were shaken up several times by incoming migration and external events. But the reality is that this idea of a vacuum that we were tossing around in the early 2000s had just never historically been the case. So the difficulty is that our starting point was wrong. Our starting point was formal state institutions are a good thing. People will naturally welcome them. But of course, if they are displacing established actors, there are winners and losers in that process. And when you're starting from a fairly low level of capacity, you're displacing a system which works, maybe not perfectly, with a system that may work considerably less well. And this is what lay behind a lot of the resistance that our work saw, some of which was passive and some of which was actually quite violent, is a attachment to alternative systems, other ways of doing business, and sometimes simply vested interests, groups that were benefiting from an alternative arrangement. We just underestimated the extent to which there would be winners and losers in that process.
Folly number three is interesting. Geographical denial. Can you explain why planners felt geography could be overlooked as a major factor? To what extent did it help to relocate the headquarters of MONUSCO to the east in 2014?
I think what happened is that the early enthusiasm for state building as a way that peacekeeping missions could exit was fed by qualified success in places like Sierra Leone, in places like Liberia, obviously with faults, but still it was a point that was good enough that drawdown on a considerable scale was contemplated. And at the time that this was in discussion in DRC, you had the same approach being taken in places like Kosovo and Timor-Leste. And there just wasn't an adjustment of that to the geographic circumstances of the DRC. There's a very big and very interesting literature on historical state formation in these very big countries. And essentially, the very short version of that is that the ability to project power or to establish legitimacy over these large distances and very difficult topography grew only slowly. And still, in very big countries with weak governments like Pakistan or Nigeria, or even a relatively good government for the region like Senegal, you still have areas in which the presence of the state is very, very light. It's not called on to do all that much, and nor would people welcome it trying to do all that much. This rather different experience, I think, was overlooked in the case of the Congo. We were looking at early successes as they were seen without really stepping back and thinking, well, how does this translate to a context that physically looks very, very different.
You mentioned in your book that donors, the UN, national authorities were heavily involved in planning and implementing stabilization programs. Why were civil society and the local population not consulted on major programs that were clearly aimed at impacting their lives?
This is a thorny question, and it was one of the key lines of criticism for stabilization efforts. A lot of NGOs decried the UN extending predatory governance was a phrase that kept recurring, or building on sand, building on a foundation that simply could not support what we were trying to do. And there's a lot of validity to the criticism, to be completely honest. Early drafts of stabilization frameworks were drawn up with a fairly small circle of interlocutors in Kinshasa. And these were the people who were sitting in the big chair. This was head of government, key cabinet officials. Now, the reasons that was done, I think you have to look back to the way that international institutions are actually set up. This was not because the people on the ground were not aware that there were issues with the legitimacy and the competence, to be perfectly frank, in some cases, of these officials. It was more that their standard operating procedures, the operating software of their institutions, really pointed them in that direction. If you look at the UN side, the development agencies and the humanitarian agencies as well, but certainly the development agencies, standard job descriptions and the well-established processes for programming state unambiguously that the point of reference is national authorities. And this is something that has been reinforced by the General Assembly time after time, has been reinforced by the executive boards of these organizations time after time. So we're looking at a global practice that in the DRC's specific circumstances led us into some problems. But to ask for a completely different approach without reaching back to where this operating model was coming from is asking too much of people in country. It's quite a difficult adaptation to make. Likewise, when you look at the diplomatic side, the financial and political partners that we were dealing with, they are accredited by a national government. As happened, that national government says you may not have a presence outside of the capital. This is not your job. It's a very unusual thing for those institutions to push back, for them to go to their foreign office and say, we want to establish a permanent presence in areas the government doesn't want us to be. This is a big ask for diplomats. This is not to excuse the fact. It did lead us down some very dangerous paths, but it does flow back to a failure to think about what a good, inclusive, or more open policy process would look like in Congo, and then securing the agreement of the wider stakeholders, the headquarters level of all of these many agencies operating there, to convince them that this was the right approach in the DRC's case.
The release of your book coincides with the launch of the UN's high-level panel report on peace operations, which similarly tries to capture the key issues needed to reform UN peacekeeping operations. However, how can the necessary adaptations you suggest in your book be implemented in practice?
We hear messages like these recommendations of the high-level panel once every 10 years. We hear a contradictory set of messages 100 times a day while we're sitting at our desk in the secretariat or as a consultant in whatever field mission I happen to be in. There does need to be a modeling of what this behavior looks like from the top, and that has to be linked with a serious working through of what the moving parts are. If we want to do local engagement, what does that actually mean for our core systems and processes, for our human resources profile, and for the people that pay the bills and provide the troops in the case of peacekeeping? And there are a lot of implications there. This is not straightforward stuff. An obvious one, security protocols have to change. There has to be a change from a compliance risk management perspective to more of a balancing of risk versus reward in terms of the access and the situation awareness that you get from greater proximity to the local population. The unit of planning for things like the results-based budgeting system of the peacekeeping mission has to change. It is written for the national unit, really for analytical simplicity, but it would have to be restructured into something that was tailored to local approaches. None of this stuff is easy. And in fact, in an intergovernmental organization, all of this stuff is hard because it has to pass through a quite complicated committee system. But nonetheless, if we're serious about doing it, We have to translate that high-level statement of what's needed into a clear-sighted thinking through of what the implications actually are in a very practical way. And that then needs to be linked with resources.
The book is Follies in Fragile States, How the International Stabilization Failed in the Congo. The author is Mr. Ian Quick. Thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you the next time you're in town at IPI.
Thank you. Appreciate it.